from the super-powered studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. It is time for another amazing hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. Why don't spring bulbs freeze to death? Can Venus flytraps keep time? And can a potato really charge your cell phone? I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, we'll discuss the superpowers of plants, plus how to avoid the most common cause of tomato failure, and your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and dramatically delivered denunciations. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up like you asking your plants what time it is.
WDIY has been broadcasting in the Lehigh Valley and beyond for 30 years, providing news.
These planes were hijacked.
The Bethlehem Steel Corporation will end its steelmaking production in Bethlehem.
We hope that you enjoyed hearing from the Dalai Lama.
Local public affairs.
As I say, it's a race of interest.
What we're experiencing today will later on be studied.
And music.
My name is Janice Ian.
Our guest, Lake Street Dive.
In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Petey Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary.
WDIY, since 1995.
From the overheated studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, it's time for another poorly shaded hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's edition of In the News, we reveal that federal funds are being clawed back from America's most historic horticultural facility in a story the Philadelphia Inquirer perfectly titles, EPA cancels $500,000 grant to Bartram's Garden for urban tree planting. As reported by Mike Newell, federal officials have notified historic Bartram's Garden that a $500,000 EPA grant they received last year has been terminated. The grant would have supported 50 paid youth internships to plant 200 trees and 120 home gardens in Southwest Philadelphia. We would have been able to reach directly into the neighborhood with these resources, says the executive director of Bartram's Garden. This would have been a way for people to connect with nature in a neighborhood that has very little nature in it, and to make their community safer and healthier. The cut comes as Bartram's was preparing to hire the project's 50 high school students. A spokesperson for the EPA explains, as with any change in administration, the agency is reviewing its grant funding to ensure appropriate use of taxpayer dollars and how the programs align with administration priorities. Bartram's director feels that, quote, our Environmental Protection Agency no longer values providing shade trees and access to food in city neighborhoods and is no longer concerned with helping young people prepare for job opportunities. In addition, 14 local EPA employees have been put on leave as President Trump and Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency continue to drastically shrink the federal workforce. NPR reports that a $75 million Forestry Service initiative to plant trees in disadvantaged urban areas has also been defunded. City Council member Jamie Gauthier emphasizes that such jobs and greening programs are critical in disadvantaged neighborhoods. This is a community that already doesn't have adequate tree cover, she explains. That means that folks could feel as much as 20 degrees hotter in the summer than folks who live in wealthier communities, adding that the gardening jobs would have also helped keep young people off the streets and provide them with valuable job training. The program was designed to teach young people skills about planting and maintaining gardens that they could have used for the rest of their lives. Bartram's hopes to find other funds to hire students for the summer and will look to the city to help supplement some of the lost funding to continue the plantings and community gardening efforts. Says the director, "We'll have to scale it back, but I'm really eager not to lose any of our young students." Bartram's Garden, a National Historic Landmark, predates the American Revolution and was a major supplier of plants and seeds to such founding gardeners as George Washington, John Adams, and Thomas Jefferson, who once declared, quote, "The greatest service that can be rendered by any country is to add a useful plant to its culture."
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, another important and seasonal question of the week. It's coming up after another of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Cindy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. It's good to talk to you.
Hey, it's good to talk to you, Cindy. How you doing?
I'm great. It's terrible weather here today, though.
Where is here?
This is Salina, Kansas, so kind of in the middle of Kansas.
Oh, okay. All right. What can we do for Cindy in Salina?
Well, I've been growing garlic for a lot of years, following your method, and had great luck. And then the last couple years, I thought, I must have done something wrong when I was curing the garlic, because it would dry out and just all that's left is the husk, kind of, and get these brown spots on it. And I thought, well, maybe I dried it in the sun too long or something. And then I finally figured out that I think I have garlic mites, and I don't know what to do about that.
Okay. Now, let's try to quantify. How many years have you been growing garlic?
Oh, 10.
Okay.
Maybe more.
And you grow in raised beds, flat earth, containers?
They're quasi-raised beds. I don't have the funds to build, you know, really deep. I've got used boards and bricks, and so they're raised up like 6 inches at the most.
Now, do you rotate your garlic at all?
Yeah, I try to rotate everything around.
Now, this is the first time you've had your failure, right?
Well, last year, too. It just wasn't as bad last year, I think.
Okay. Well, you were due. I must have been growing garlic for 20 years, thinking I was the world's biggest genius, and then I started to encounter problems. So last year, we had, you know, the whole season to look at. You planted cloves in the fall.
Right.
Where'd you get your cloves?
From the previous year.
Okay. And you planted your cloves in the fall. Whether or not they sprouted in the fall makes no, never mind. So in the spring, the greenery came up. How did it look when it emerged?
It looked great. And I got lots of scapes, ate all those. Yeah, it looked fine until been in storage a bit, I think.
Okay. So you did harvest scapes.
Yeah.
That's good. you, those little bulges at the top of garlic in late spring, early summer, would turn into seed heads. And that both sucks energy from the bulb underground, and if they're allowed to explode, spreads onion grass throughout your garden, which...
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Some crazy people will actually let their garlic, quote, go to seed. It will form little seeds inside what becomes a ball at the top of the garlic. That's how they came up with ornamental alliums. They just kept crossbreeding until the ball was bigger and more colorful. But there's little seeds in there, and you can plant those, and you won't get garlic, but you'll get a bigger seed. And, you know, do that for 4 or 5 years, and you'll actually grow out your own garlic. If that's your idea of a good time, I have better things to do.
I don't have that much patience, no.
Yeah. So when you harvested, did you make sure it was during a dry spell?
It's always dry here. We don't get wet spells.
Okay. So your garlic tends to be spicy.
Gosh, I don't know. I do water things.
Okay.
I don't know if it's any spicier than normal.
Okay. So in July, you pulled the bulbs out of the ground. And then you said you used the word dry. I would use the word cure. How did you handle your harvest?
Well, I don't have like a porch, but I have a table underneath a grape arbor that I spread them out on and just leave them for like a day.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, you know, it is really hot here. You know, it could be in the hundreds here that time of year.
Right.
So I thought maybe I just let them get too hot and dry at first.
My experience with grape arbors, if they're lush, it's like outdoor air conditioning.
Yeah. I don't know if mine's that lush, but...
How far is it from the house?
It's hooked onto the house.
Oh, okay. So there's no reason you couldn't take a circulating fan out there and train it on the garlic.
Right.
Okay.
I could do that.
Yes. So you'd take a circulating fan out there and you know to brush the dirt off as the garlic dries, but not to wash it, right?
Right.
So you've only let it cure for a day. We're going to let it cure for like a week or 10 days if weather permits. And,
no kidding.
And keep that fan trained on it during the day. You don't have to run it at night. And obviously abandon ship if rain is called for. So
Okay. Normally
when you bring it inside, what do you do then?
I just put it in the basement.
All of it? You don't look at it?
Not too much. No, I leave it in the bulb. I don't take it apart or anything.
Are all your bulbs perfect? Everything has a nice paper wrapper. There's...
I would say mostly, except sometimes when I dig, I injure a few, and those I use first, you know.
Okay. Only store perfect bulbs.
Don't
have any imperfect bulbs in with your what's going to be your planting stock, really. Use anything that's damaged. Use this an excuse to, like, make chicken with 5 garlic bulbs, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
If one clove is damaged, you want to use up that whole head.
Okay.
And then I'm going to guess, obviously, a couple of months later, you bring it up, you take a look at it, and you pull it apart, and you use the biggest cloves for replanting, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And what do you do with the rest?
A lot of them I can just leave them in the basement until I'm ready to use them, or else I roast them. Or I just put them in the fridge drawer.
Oh, no, don't put them in the fridge.
No.
Garlic and tomatoes should never be refrigerated. It destroys the flavor compounds. So,
All right.
You're growing hardneck garlic, right? Not softneck, because you said it scapes.
Right, hardneck.
Okay. Now, in the fall, when you plant your next round, obviously, I want you to use the cleanest bed you can find it would be great to add some compost in there and some perlite. Although where you are, you know, heavy soils from heavy rains are not going to be a problem.
Now, my soil's pretty good. I mean, the structure, I know I need more compost, but it's hard to get enough.
Well, you know, the fall is when you got to make it. You may not
right.
have a lot of deciduous trees, but you got a lot of corn stalks in Kansas, right?
Well, yeah.
Shred those up. Those are your fall leaves. Those are your dry brown
okay.
material, and you'll make very high quality compost with those.
Okay. I rake the neighbor's yards and save all their leaves.
Good, good.
And you used to be able to drive around and pick up leaves in bags, but the city won't let you put your leaves in bags anymore. So
oh, okay. Yeah, I miss those days. Now, in the fall, you're going to do something new.
Okay.
Okay, so you want to get a half gallon of the cheapest vodka you can find.
Oh.
It'll be on the bottom shelf.
Yuck.
It'll be ridiculously low priced. And people who check you out may say, you're not going to drink this, are you? But what you're going to do is you are going to get a bunch of cloves ready. Only plant perfect cloves. Now, you want to make sure they have the individual wrappers around them. If there's naked flesh showing, use that for dinner that night.
Okay.
So you want to fill a bowl with some of the vodka, and you want to let your garlic cloves sit in that vodka for a good 10, 20 minutes, swirling it around. Then you want to move them into another bowl in which you have put baking soda and water. And you didn't see any mites, right? You didn't see any actual little creatures.
Right.
Yeah, I think you have a soil-borne disease.
Oh, really?
Which is common when you've been growing garlic over and over again. It happens to the best of us. It happened to me, and I'm the best of us.
That's what I called.
So then you want to swirl it around in the baking soda for another 20 minutes, and then plant. And when you're all done and the garlic is covered over, you can pour the leftover baking soda and vodka over top of it for good luck. But the vodka will kill any pathogens that are on the garlic, and the baking soda will act as a natural disease preventative in the ground.
Wow, that's such a great idea. Okay. I'm excited to try that. So what do you think about like a teaspoon of baking soda per cup of water, that kind of solution?
Oh, God, you're talking to somebody who's never measured anything in his life. I generally, you know, the baking soda comes in those little one-pound bricks. I'll put about half of that into a double-sized cereal bowl and then fill it with water. Not a place to be cheap.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds good.
All right?
All right. Perfect.
All right. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Mike.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and deliver a final warning that I will give a free talk at the Allentown Public Library on Tuesday, April 15th at 6 p.m. I'll answer your garden questions, sign books, and tell lots of tall tales. But don't go making your plans to be there just yet, because we'll be right back to discuss plants with superpowers and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past three decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610-694-8000. 8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, another important and seasonal question of the week. And, of course, more of your important and seasonal questions to me. But now it is time to welcome our special guest, David Dominey, who, among other things, is a fellow of the London Colleges of Horticulture, a chartered fellow of the Chartered Institute of Horticulture, and a fellow of the Linnaean Society, among many other titles to his name. David has written a new book called Plants with Superpowers. It is published by Francis Lincoln. David, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, and hi to you, Mike.
I'm sorry with that introduction. We're out of time. It was good talking to you, and hope to have you back someday.
Well, that's good of you. That's good of you. Well, I'm here in England. I live in a town called Stratford-upon-Avon, which is where Shakespeare was born.
So I have been to Stratford-upon-Avon, and what most people don't realize is that the main street of the town where the thatched homes have reached out so far over the road that they meet in the middle, and it's kind of a shaded alley of roofs.
It is. It's all black beams and white houses, Tudor time, really. And there's lots of quaint cottages. We're near the Cotswolds, where all the little streams run through the centre of the house with the golden stone brickwork. It's very quaint, I suppose. Is the word.
Yeah, it's a very nice place. It, very convenient when you're in London. It's just a short hop away. Stratford, Stonehenge, you can see a lot without going very far.
That's the beauty of England. It's so small, certainly compared to your country. For us to drive up to Scotland, it's about 4 hours. It seems like an impossible journey. But for you guys, that's just down the road. Yeah, and we've got a beautiful spring here. I was filming this morning for a TV show that I do, and we were doing all the blossom, the early blossom, Prunus yedinensis, the first ones. And I was down at Kew Gardens, which is a big garden near London. And the marvels of spring just erupting across the country. And there's a little bit of warmth. So I've already had a cheeky barbecue, which is something particularly, well, should we say, dramatic for the UK, because we've had some very cold winter. But we're coming out the other end, and the sight of the plants coming into flower uplifts the heart and nourishes the soul.
Now, what was the common name you used?
Prunus yedinensis is one of the first flowering cherries that you get. It's just the Yoshino cherry. You might know it as a common name.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, everybody here in the States, they're focusing on the cherry blossoms. It's displaced the apple blossom over the centuries as the American tree that's the harbinger of spring. But I have a flowering crabapple at my property, so I just look at the cherry blossoms on TV from the nation's capital.
Well, they're all part of the same family, aren't they? I think when it comes down to pears and cherries and plums and hawthorn and blackthorn, they're all in the rosaceae family. So the magic of the blossom and all of them, and the good thing about it is you get that balance. It starts with us at the end of March, running right the way through to May, and different plants with slightly different shaped flowers, different colored showers, different habits as well. All of them bring in spring. And I think the Japanese, they have a thing about it. They plant them in front of schools and businesses because the sight of the cherries, it's supposed to be renewal and rebirth. And when you think about the length of time the flower has, well, if you're lucky, 10 days, 14 days before it falls, it really signifies the passing beauty of life. And it really sort of instills in us to, you know, to embrace the day and make the most of our lives as we come into spring.
Yeah, at this time of year, we're going through a terrible drought, kind of an invisible drought because it hit us over the winter. But things are bone dry. And, of course, we're praying for rain. but we don't want it to rain when the apple blossoms and the cherry blossoms just open, because then it's a two-day show.
Yes, it is. So that's the thing about it all, is the passing of nature and the colour. And that's the one good thing about having such a variety of different flowering trees and shrubs that come to life. You know, there's something in flower almost every day of the year. It was only a moment ago I was planting witch hazel, the hellebores are up. Well, we got a little one, which is a perennial wallflower, Eurycium. And it always seems to be in flower in my garden. During the winter, not so much. But during the winter, I appreciate them a hell of a lot more, because exactly, it's showing a bit of color at a time I need to pick it up.
I always said that daffodils were given to us to help us escape the month of March.
Oh, well, that's the thing. In fact, they came when they populated into the UK. The first time daffodils came up, it was the Romans. The Romans collected them from the Iberian Peninsula in Spain and over in Portugal. And they brought them when they were doing their campaigns in England. And when a fallen comrade was to die and buried, they'd bury a bulb with the dead colleague, dead Roman. And that's how they started to pick up and grow across the UK.
And plenty of nutrition for the growing bulb clumps.
Well, you could look at it that way. We all return to the earth. There's more microorganism life in one handful of soil than there are humans in the planet. So the thought is it's a living world, and we're just part of it as much as everything else is.
Now, for this book, Plants with Superpowers, you chose 75 plants that stood out to you for their attributes. And I should say, this is the kind of book I love, because you can pick it up, you can read a section. Everything, I believe, is 2 pages, and you can put it down. Then you can just flip randomly. You can look something up. But it's a great put up and down book, pick up and put down book. I would think it's a perfect, for me, vacation book, because I'm not going to read a huge novel. I'm just going to want to read a couple of pages and then stare at the ocean again.
It's perfect. Yeah, it's the type of book you're on your lunch, you're on the train, you're on the toilet. It's a point where you can just open and close and digest a double page spread and learn something new about the fascinations of plants. Now, what I've chosen these 75. Then these aren't 75 plants that some of them are on the top of the mountain range, the bottom of the sea, or in the darkest jungles of Borneo. No, these are 75 plants that you can grow in your own home and garden. And each one of them has a secret or ability that's unique to any other, that kindles the fascination that we used to have when we were kids learning about plants, climbing trees, daisy chains, conkers, snapdragons, all of those things that engaged and amazed us about nature. And I wanted to create a book for adults that we could dip in and become real amazed as we're learning something new, and in some cases shocking, about plants we know in everyday life.
And one of the ones you lead off with is very appropriate for our spring blooming talk at the top of the interview. It is the snowdrop, the plant that produces its own antifreeze.
Yes, and who would have believed it? A snowdrop that comes in the most difficult times, sub-zero temperatures outside, yet this little plant manages to push itself through. It's got a hardened tip. The French call it pierce-neige, meaning the snow piercer. And it comes up and it grows where any other plant with soft tissue at that time of year, as the frost crystallizes the water within the cells, would burst it and kill it. But the snowdrop has a unique ability. It has this protein that's an antifreeze that stops crystallization of water in its stems. And that's how it can survive and thrive when everything else is asleep during the sub-zero temperatures. What an amazing little plant.
It is. I've always called it nature's Prozac. It's rescuing us from the doldrums of winter.
Yes, and that's the magic. So every little plant. And the other thing is, we all naturally assume that snowdrop earrings were named after the plant, but it was the plant named after the earrings. That was the about face. And this little plant has become a symbol of endurance during difficult times and achieving against all odds.
And it not only is super hardy, but it is very fruitful. You don't have to plant a lot of snowdrops in the fall to eventually have hundreds in the spring a few years later.
Not all bulbs do that. Of course, tulips eventually run themselves out of energy, and likewise hyacinths. But things like snowdrops and daffodils and crocus, once they're in the ground, it's a single purchase that becomes an investment in the garden, and they pop up every... And in this day and age, Mike, it's one of those things that teaches us about reward after everything's instant. Remember the old days, we used to take photos, you have to take your film into the chemist to get developed or posted off, and now everything is instant. Bulbs is great, certainly for kids, teaching them to plant in autumn, wait for the winter, and then just when you've forgotten all about them, they start to erupt from the soil, that greenery and that excitement, that hope, and that motivation and pleasurable feeling of seeing something that you did the work for earlier on. And in a world of instantaneous life, this is something that enriches our appreciation of nature and the passage of time and return of effort.
I am of the age that when I was 8 and 10 years old, you could buy Venus flytraps from the classified ads in Marvel Comics. And they would be sent to you, obviously 3/4 dead already, with instructions to feed them hamburger. We know that that does not work. But you give this plant the power of counting. It knows how many flies it's eaten.
Well, it's not the fly. It's an amazing thing. You just think to the concept that a plant can count. Now, we can all count one, 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 but you need a memory to be able to count from one to two, and a memory that you counted two to three. This plant has a memory and can count up to 30. Now, let's just ever think about it. The Venus flytrap has evolved over time. Its ancestors go back about 60 million years, and obviously it's native from eastern and northern Carolina right the way down to eastern and southern Carolina. And the plant itself closes. You know, you put your finger in and sometimes it doesn't close. Well, that's because it's got sensors inside, because it's not its flower, it's a modified leaf. When something lands in it and it closes, the plant goes into digestion, and if there's nothing in there, it wastes the energy. So it needs to work out, is that a fly or is that a leaf that's just blown in? So the little sensors trigger a calcium clock. So something touches one of those little hairs and the plant starts to count. One, two, three. And if it hits 30, then it resets again. But if it moves again, it must think it's another sensor's touched. There's every chance that being a fly, and that's when it closes. And after a couple of more touches, it goes in for the squeeze.
But if it's still there after 30 touches, it's a leaf and you want to spit it out.
Yeah, and what it does is it just doesn't close. So it resets and waits for a hair to be touched again. So the first hair is almost like pulling back the trigger. Second touch is where it enacts the close. Yeah, but how marvelous, a plant with a memory and that can count. And a little snowdrop that has an antifreeze ability. And of course, there's 73 other plants we've just as an amazing fact to so rekindle our childhood and our fascination with nature.
And I'm just paging through and picking a plant that catches my eye. And I love what you did about magnolias.
Oh, the magnolias is something, because a magnolia, they've been on the planet for between 142 and 65 million years. In fact, they were on the planet when the Tyrannosaurus Rex was about. And they predate, they're some of the earliest flowers on the planet, and they predate flying pollinators. So there was no bees about in those days. And magnolias are lovely because they're precocious. They come out into flower before the leaves to make the flowers more prominent for pollination. And they get pollinated by beetles rather than by flying insects. And it's very clever. We have this thing, I don't know whether you have it in America, called a lock-in. When it's past closing time in the pubs, Sometimes the landlord would wait until some of the other people leave and then just close the doors, pull the curtains for a late drink. Do you have some of those there?
Oh, yes. Yes, we do. After hours clubs.
That's it. Well, the beetles have after-hours clubs in the magnolia flower. So what happens is obviously the flower's got two parts in the center, the female part and the male part, because they sexually reproduce just like we do as humans. So what happens is the beetle goes in during the day and the female receptors are open to collect the pollen that's on the beetle. But at night, as soon as it hits the dust, the flower closes up. And some of the beetles are in there for a lock-in or after. after hours, as you say. And while they're in there all cozy, they can't get back out, and they cover themselves in pollen as they gorge in it. Next morning, the flower opens and the beetles leave, and with other flowers, all the female receptors open, and covered in pollen, the beetles then go into the other flowers. It is all happening in your garden.
And the landlord brushes them out the door and says, go home now.
That's right. That's right. And they all head off to the local kebab shop or something similar. But it's that magic. So every time you look at a magnolia, think a Tyrannosaurus rex would have been noticing that type of flower whilst it's out and about. And the fact that we don't know it, in those flowers and looking so beautiful, there's a whole beetle party going down.
I can't wait for the next Jurassic Park movie when we see a T-Rex collecting a bouquet of magnolias to, you know, take to the female. And it's historically accurate, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, that's the magic. The research has been very hard work, because I'm a horticulturist, writing about the plants is great, but identifying different parts of history and also how certain plants interact with the brain, how plants can help you lose weight. The potato, for instance, is nature's battery.
I was going to say that, but since you bring it up, can you really charge a cell phone from a potato?
With the right type of, obviously you've got to change your alternate and direct current. With the right wiring, yes. So an average size potato, with the help of a zinc nail and some copper wire, you might have done those experiments when you were kids at school. A medium sized potato with the electrochemical energy within there, within the acid and the starch that's in there, can light up an LED light bulb for 40 days. The pro rata of charging a mobile phone, it seems very practical.
So it's the end of the world. All your portable power supplies are dead. You've run out of alkaline batteries. Hopefully you have a potato bin somewhere.
Do you know, that's nature. It's there. It's just out there. The potato itself has that energy within there and has inspired some of the early batteries. It's just amazing. And all plants have, well, many of the plants, certainly the ones in these books, all of them have specific abilities that would blow your mind. I mean, a walnut, for instance, a simple walnut. When you open the walnut, one of the things that strikes you does look a bit like a human brain. That shape and those swirls around looks like the human brain. So when I started looking into that, saying what interaction could it have, and there's lots of different chemicals within it. I won't list them all out, but one particular is linoleic acid and polyphenols. And they have a great ability to improve our memory, our cognition, and our motor function. So it does practically help the brain by ingesting and using those components. But it also has polyunsaturated fatty acids, which is well known for improving brain health. When you add into the fact that the walnut also contains compounds to improve your sleep, you're thinking healthier operation of the brain with memory and motor function, brain health as well with the unsaturated fatty acids, and a decent night's sleep for refreshments. Walnuts are brain food.
Oh, yes. And when you talk about the walnut resembling the brain, you're going back to the theory of similars, right?
Absolutely. The connection to it in many cases, because they believe that walnuts connected to 45,000 years, they reckon there's recordings and statements and that we have been using walnuts, other nuts, of course, but walnut in particular, highlighted my interest in that. And there's loads of things. Shape-shifting, for instance, there are plants that can generally change the entire design and shape of their leaf as part of a protection. I mean, natural holly, the native holly, Ilex aquifolium, has the ability to change the shape of its leaf. Normally, it is a smooth outer leaf, but where it's being eaten by goats or deer or a hedge trimmer, when the leaves grow back, they grow back spiky. So the holly leaves are spiky because it's their defense mechanism. We call it heterophilia. So the leaves actually change shape. How lovely is that? What a story.
Right. They knew they were attacked and they have to come back as a different type of plant.
Absolutely. And some of these plants, just the simplest thing you wouldn't naturally associate. So take, for instance, there are plants called hypercumulators. They have the ability to absorb high concentrates of toxic materials. So you just think part of the land has been polluted. And this could be anything, zinc, copper, lead. And if you think, actually, in Chernobyl and Fukushima, both Ukraine and Japan, where there was the power plant disasters, and there was a high concentrate of radioactive waste, both in the water and in the soil. They planted some of these hypercumulator plants that draw up all the poisons in the earth, hold them in their stems and their leaves. Then they're cropped, and through a process of pyrolysis, they separate through a high burning the metals from the plant itself. So these plants are purifying the earth from radioactive and toxic waste. You think to yourself, what plant could do that? Is it giant bamboos? Is it grasses? Is it bramble? No, it's sunflowers.
And alfalfa, I believe, is another plant used for bioremediation.
Yeah, plants can purify the earth. And I selected sunflower out of all of them because it is particularly practical. And there are others, and bamboos and other grass-like can do the similar thing, these hyperaccumulators. But the sunflower, I thought, it's the plant that you naturally associate with something of just sight and beauty. To have this ability to purify the earth in the same game really makes you look at them in a completely different way.
Well, we could do 75 plants easily, and I think you've already strayed to plants that are not even in the book, so you're thinking about a second one. But I'll tell you what, let's throw a bone to the Hogwarts fans. Why do you think blackthorn was chosen as the best wood for magic wands?
Well, there's a lot of speculation of what wands were used, and there's lots of things made from different wands. But the most historic data that has gone back is that blackthorn was chosen. So blackthorn is quite unique. It's just coming out into color at the moment in our gardens. And it was fabled in witchcraft that it was the preferred choice for the wands themselves. In Celtic mythology, the thorns of blackthorn were held to provide a great deal of protection against evil. While Irish folklore said that some of it was possessed by ghosts of dead witches. So it's a lot of history that relates to blackthorn. I suppose if you were to look at it straightforward, it's got quite pliable branches. There are some thorns in it. Beautiful white flowers, lots of stamens in there. Quite haunting, metallic, bluey purple fruit that goes with it. So the association of blackthorn out of all of them, I would have said, made a great deal of sense.
Well, it's clear that your love of plants is beyond Olympian. People will have a ball running through your book, discovering this, discovering that. Great way to kill 10 minutes, or great thing to read before you go to a party so you have an interesting tidbit to share with someone. The book is Plants with Superpowers. The author is David Domoney, Domoney. The publisher is Francis Lincoln, which is a division of Quattro. And David, it's been charming to have you on the show. What a real pleasure. Thank you.
Really nice talking to you, Mike. Thank you very much.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and proudly announce that our presenting NPR station, WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, is now holding their spring pledge drive. And I want to be a part of it. So if you make a generous pledge, you can make that pledge of support by calling 610-758-8810. That's weekdays 6 to 9 p.m. Or if you're listening on the weekend, 8 to 7 p.m. Or you can always pledge at wdiy.org. So pick up the phone, give them a call at 610-758-8810 or pledge online at wdiy.org. And we thank you for your support. You're walking around outside and your ankles are itching like never before. Could it be fleas, or is the dreaded chigger doing the damage? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss how to safely repel a wide range of annoying insects. plus the question of the week and your fabulous phone calls. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of NPR station WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we are in the stretch right now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, I will talk about a disease that's affecting a tree that actually could be much more devastating to your tomatoes. It's coming up after another of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Hillary, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks so much, Mike. I'm happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you here, Hillary. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
And where is Hillary doing well?
In Fort Collins, Colorado.
Oh, okay. Okay, and what can we do for Hillary in Colorado?
I've got a question about rabbit poop.
Go ahead.
So I planted a cover crop in my garden last fall, and the rabbits ended up loving it so much, munched on it all winter long, and I've noticed that they've left behind quite a bit of dropping. And I'm wondering if it's safe to leave them in the garden or if I should try and rake out those tiny pellets.
Well, and did they take care of killing it for the season for you?
You know, it did look less grown than it usually has at this time of the year, but it's made a little bit of a comeback. So I feel like it's still going to be effective. Not as much as usual, but they definitely took it down pretty good.
Because as I mentioned recently, rye is one of those cover crops that behaves very differently in different locales and based on the exact type of rye. But had your rabbits not killed your rye, how would you have handled planting around it?
I till it in like right around now, mm-hmm. and then I don't plant into those rows. I use them for my summer crop, so I won't be planting into those rows until about 1st of June, late May. So it just breaks down, you know, from now until then. And then I plant directly into that row.
Do you do anything to get rid of the seed heads on the rye?
You know, it doesn't get big enough to go to seed,
actually.
Okay. Right. Yeah.
You kind of have a short season where you are.
Yep.
One of the times I was in Colorado, we were staying with a couple on their farm near Cortez. And the young woman who was gallantly growing tomatoes told me that the previous year they had snow in June.
Yep, that's not uncommon here, that's for sure. And I know you always say to wait till those nights are up in the 50s until you put those warm weather crops in. And that takes definitely the first week of June for us.
I also think that some parts of Colorado, depending on where you are a little bit more like Southeast Alaska and England,
mountains.
Where you might need some sort of small greenhouse apparatus
Absolutely.
To actually grow tomatoes and peppers and make sure you get some ripe ones.
Luckily, I'm on the Front Range, so I don't have to worry about that too much. We still have a short season, but not as short as those folks that live in the mountains.
Yes, exactly. All right, let's get to down to poop here. rabbit poop is one of the best natural fertilizers you can possibly have. Rabbits are herbivores, so there's no problems with any kind of disease organisms being involved as there is with animals that, you know, eat everything.
Yeah, that's what I was mostly worried about.
The fertilizer contents, so to speak, are very balanced. It is a great balanced fertilizer. It's not heavy in nitrogen like horse or poultry manure. And it's slow release, as you know. I mean, it comes pelletized for you.
So it's a good thing then.
Yeah.
Sounds like.
Do you make compost?
I do. Yep. And I also keep chickens. And I compost their poop before I put it into the garden.
Okay.
So, I'm versed in all of that. But, so that's why I was a little worried about, you know, the rabbit droppings going right into the garden and not being composted first.
No.
Sounds like it's better.
And right? it sounds like they didn't eat anything that you wanted to remain. So I would call this free fertilizer.
All right. That's a win.
So, yeah, your two choices are to mix it into your compost.
Yep.
Where it will become one with everything else and even enhance your already wonderful compost, I am sure. Yeah. Or you can side dress your plants with it. And as with any kind of pelletized fertilizer, even though this was pelletized by nature, you want to cover it with a little bit of soil. If you use it around your plants. So, and again, especially with your short season, you know, that'll help its soil activate. So dig a little trench, drop the pellets in, cover them with soil, and they will release their fertilizer throughout the growing season.
All right. Well, maybe I'll have the best garden yet this year.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate the advice.
Oh, my pleasure. Great to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mike.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
As promised, it is time for the question of the week, which we are calling Maple Tree Wilt, and a very timely tomato warning. Martin in Denison, Iowa writes, I'm wondering about maple tree wilt. My neighbor has a large maple tree, and the leaves started wilting after it leafed out last spring. Is the tree dying, and will the problem spread to the maple trees in my yard? Well, I had never heard of, quote, maple tree wilt before. At least I don't think I ever heard of it. Hey, anybody know where my car keys are? And so into the research swamp I went. Turns out that we're talking about a soil-borne problem that tomato growers know all too well. Verticillium wilt, which famously causes tomato plants grown in the same spot for 3 years or more to suffer and or just plain die. To recap that love apple warning, grow a healthy tomato plant in what seems to be an ideal spot, and you should get a good harvest. And then, why would you not plant in that seemingly perfect spot the following year? The answer, obvious only to those of us with X-ray vision, is that a soil-borne wilt called verticillium in the north, and you can't get much more north than Iowa, and its nasty cousin fusarium in the south, have been slowly attracted to the roots of that plant, but not in concentrations great enough to cause any problems yet. The second year you plant in that same spot, you may notice some yellowing of the bottom leaves of the plant, but not enough to cause concern. Underground, however, another story is occurring. The population of the wilt organism is now thriving, but you'll still get a nice batch of tomatoes that season. However, by year number three, the yellowing will develop sooner and move faster up the vine. This is your final warning. If you plant in that same spot in year four, your romas will be ruined by July. Luckily, the solution is easy. Just plant in another spot that's at least 2 feet away the following year. Then let the original location remain tomato-free for 2 or 3 years, and the wilt in that ground will essentially starve to death. But we're supposed to be talking about trees here, which are much harder to rotate. Let's turn to a very informative bulletin from Michigan State University for some answers. Symptoms of verticillium wilt on maples can be confusing because they are so variable. They include scorch marks on leaf margins and complete wilting of leaves in the crowns of potential hosts. Symptoms can occur at any time of the year, but often show up when hot, dry weather begins. Sometimes a single branch or the foliage on one side of an entire tree will die. Trees can go years without symptoms, and then the problem can show up again seasons later. Some trees can struggle along for years, while others may die soon after symptoms appear. In addition to wilting, other symptoms may include small leaves, stunted shoot growth, sparse foliage, and abnormally large seed drops. I'll add that many things with no connection to verticillium could also cause these kinds of problems. They include exposure to winter road salt, girdling, which often occurs when mulch is mounded up against the trunk of the tree in a complete circle, overwatering, underwatering, and many other issues. If you fear that one of your maples is affected, Michigan suggests you send a sample to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Lab at Cornell, which I heartily endorse. Details on how to take that sample are in the Michigan State article we'll link up to when we post the written version of this article. Michigan's suggestions for prevention: water the tree during dry periods, especially if these dry periods occur in summer or fall. Fertilize only if needed, and then only with a low nitrogen fertilizer. Excessive fertilization increases problems with this disease. So that means no 10, 10, 10, 20, 20, 20, or anything made by Miracle-Gro campers. If fertilize you must, use an organic product like compost or worm castings. Now, here's a fascinating note I found in the Michigan article. Colleagues at the University of Wisconsin have looked at potential hazards associated with use of wood chip mulch from trees infected with verticillium. They discovered that the pathogen will survive in these chips for up to a year. In addition, they note that Norway maples are easily infected. Other maples, not so much. So what does this mean to our worried maple owner up in Iowa? First, the verticillium wilt is attracted to vulnerable trees. Those that are underwatered, overfed, growing in compacted soil, and especially mulched heavily with wood chips. Oh, and this disease is root specific. The only way it could transfer from one tree to another is if their roots touch. It is not airborne, and insects don't transmit it. If your trees are showing signs of this illness, water them deeply, especially during dry times. Don't do anything that could compact their soil, like driving heavy equipment over top of their roots. Don't use chemical fertilizers near them, and for God's sake, avoid the horrifying but still unfortunately all too popular trend of piling wood chips against the trunk of your trees. Even if the chips aren't infected, they could and will eventually kill the tree by rotting the lower bark and smothering the root crown. As I've said many times, have you ever seen a volcano mulched tree in a healthy forest? Tree roots need to breathe, and the trunk needs to be able to dry out. Don't fall for the wood mulch scam. Well, that was hopefully some helpful advice about protecting your tomato plants and maple trees from a dread disease, now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the details over at your leisure or your leisure, and you can study that important information from Michigan State that we just mentioned by following the link for the question of the week at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to wilt my watermelons if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100 and follow the prompts to reach You Bet Your Garden. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse, teeming towards our garden shore at our new email site, youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. Either way, no matter how you contact us, please tell us where you are. We always want to know your location. You'll find our new phone number, our new Gmail address, a link to the written version of that all-important question of the week, and new and improved links to our podcast sites, all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when he forgot the words that told the robot Gort not to melt any more tanks. Speaking of melting tanks, if you have enjoyed this show and previous shows, this is your chance to show us your support by making a generous pledge. You can make that pledge of support by calling 610-758-8810, weekdays from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m., weekends from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m., or online at wdiy.org. Either way, tell them You Bet Your Garden sent you. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziproth. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. We want to send out special thanks to David Dominey, our guest today, the author of Plants with Superpowers, which is brand new from the publisher Francis Lincoln and is distributed by Quarto Books. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll be hovering over my baby seedlings and charting the progress of my three, count them, three pea plantings out in the garden until I can see you again next week.